question on insurance. Andrea, I get Joanna?
Yes.
Joanna.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Tomorrow, after discussing the last plan topic, Agenda Paper 2E, staff are planning to ask the board's permission to begin balancing a targeted exposure draft on insurance contracts. The purpose of this education session is to discuss the background material we have provided to you in assisting that decision. We will start with Agenda Paper 2B. Agenda Paper 2B. Agenda Paper 2B provides a high-level summary of the board's developed model for accounting and insurance contracts. If we look on slide 2, briefly, we'll cover the key features of the insurance contracts and how the model has accounted for it. We'll talk about what information the proposed model will communicate, and also its impact on the financial statements going forward. We have also prepared some slides on the application of the model for short-term contracts and other contracts, but I may not walk through them if we run out of time, but we're happy to take questions. You sound disappointed over there. So let's move on to the key features of an insurance contract on slide 4. Slide 4. If you think about an insurance contract, it typically has many rights and obligations, typically interdependent. In the more complex products, insurance contracts is a combination of service components. It provides insurance coverage. It provides perhaps asset management services to the policyholder. There's also an investment component. It provides a return. You might get money back even though you live. And as well as that, you may have various options and guarantees in the more complex products. Besides the guarantees of a certain amount on death, you may get a minimum interest return, for example, on your product. So at one end of the scale, insurance can be indeed a very complex set of rights and obligations. What we've decided to do in this project is to treat all of those rights and obligations within the contract boundary, so within the scope of the insurance contract standard. Only things that are distinct, so components like service components and financial instruments, embedded derivatives, for example, that are distinct, will be separately accounted for in the scope of other standards. That begs the question about what is the contract boundary. These contracts in the second row have typically renewal options, and these renewal options bind the insurer, but not necessarily the policyholder. We all have perhaps life insurance policies that continue on in many years, but we could choose to continue on with it, but the insurer has no choice. You know, if you suddenly decide to go back and say, yes, I do want to continue on, they can't then turn around and kick you out, if you like. Under our model, we will look at how likelihood those contract renewal options will be exercised and the economic consequences of those renewals when the insurer is only bound by those options. So when there has an economic underlying rationale for the insurer or in terms of some constraints on the insurer, that's only when we would consider it within the contract boundary. On slide 5, we address the age-old question about what is insurance contract revenue. It has to be said that as long as there has been insurance, there has been questions about what is the appropriate insurance contract revenue for these long-term complex products typically. The first row talks about the fact that it's received in advance, very often called the inverted production cycle, where you receive the money, the premiums up front, and you don't know when you'll be obligated to pay back or may not even need to pay back because you don't know when the insured event will or will not happen. The other row speaks about the fact that for long-term products, there is typically a deposit-like amount, either implicitly or explicitly. How do we address it in this project? Well, on the second column, we said that revenue should be reported in the statement of financial performance when services are provided, regardless of when the premiums are received, meaning regardless of whether it's all paid up upfront or over time. This revenue is consistent with how we recognize revenue in other industries and in our other IFRSs. We say in the second row that revenue will exclude this deposit-like amount because typically deposit products do not recognize revenue for the cash in, that is the deposit element. Neither do we typically put the cash out as the expenses on the face of our financial statement. And now on our final slide on the key features, which is slide six. Two more features here. One is uncertainty. As mentioned before, uncertainty is a fundamental feature of insurance contracts. We reflect this uncertainty and the fact that this uncertainty changes time to time by using current estimates of both cash flows, discount rates, and the risk adjustment. And I'll talk a bit more about these three later on in the presentation. The last row talks about the fact that these contracts return or may return an investment return. Sometimes these returns are linked to an underlying pool of assets or items, or it might even be linked to the performance of an entity. The boards have decided to reflect those investment returns returned to the policyholder in both measurement and presentation. And it's expanded a bit more in some of the slides that we're going to walk through today, but it's also expanded when I talked about the contractual linkage slides at the back. The board has also decided where there is a contractual dependence, meaning there is some sort of return that must be returned to the policyholder because the contract, that's what's in the contract, we should eliminate measurement and presentation accounting mismatches. Putting it another way, there is no economic mismatch. The board has also therefore chosen to eliminate the accounting mismatches that occur there. And we can talk about that again in a little bit further. The next section of the slides talk about what information the proposed model will communicate. Any questions so far? No. I'm sure you're comfortable enough to ask me as we go along.
Joanna, only one comment, I think, in the key features here that I felt missing when I read is that the basic feature is that the contracts must have an insurance component.
Yes.
So, and it's not really clear here if we are going to talk outside.
Yes.
Because then we go to this other key features like investment, deposit like, and then people might be confused if we don't start with a clear statement they do have an insurance risk
before
they have deposit like investment components.
That's a good point, that the insurance contract, that the contracts we're talking about here must have significant insurance risk. Okay. So if we can now turn on to slide 8. And slide 8 is a slide that you'll be used to because you've used it many times in your presentation. We have included an error to see if anyone can spot what the error is. Okay, well done. You can choose to ballot it after all. So if we start from the bottom, it's an estimate of cash flows, and it's an estimated cash flows of both inflows and outflows, as we've talked about many times in this project, of both the amounts I expect to collect from the premium, the amounts that I expect to pay out, in terms of claims, but also in terms of the fact that I have to service the claims and service the contract. So it's both inflows and outflows, and estimate it up to date, again, to reflect that uncertainty. The second one is the risk adjustment, where we're trying to quantify the difference between a certain and uncertain liability. It's almost like an adjustment to reflect that it would cost more in terms of the insurance perspective.
Can you, in correcting the mistake in the slide, can you clarify for us whether the mistake is the placement of the boxes or of the comments? Doesn't it that time value of money comes after cash flow and before risk adjustment, or Is it implied that there is a time value of money on the risk adjustment as well, which in terms of complexity is probably going beyond what we intended?
I think there's two ways you can look at it. It is true that the present value of the present value is the discounted expected value of the cash flow. So perhaps the discount rate should go with the cash flow. Another way of thinking about it, which is why we rearranged the slides a bit about, is when you come to one of the reasons why the board is going for an exposure draft, is you're talking about unlocking or adjusting the margin. And one of the questions that constituents will ask and discuss with you is the risk adjustment. And you've chosen to unlock the margin for some of the cash flows. And so we tried reordering it the other way to see whether it would work. But I take your point that in terms of a measurement view, you should theoretically start with the expected present value of the cash flows and then add on, you could then add on the risk adjustment. But we were doing it slightly differently to try to fit in more with the whole adjusting the cash flows discussion.
I'm aware of the difficulty by this unlocking, but it seems that still the logical order is to say cash flows, discounting, risk adjustment, residual margin. And yes, when we unlock, then
we kind of.
Still the basis. I think the basic approach is the one I described, and the one is just mechanics of doing that.
Mm-hmm. I guess at the end of the day, you're adjusting the cash flows for risk and for time value money, so both adjust ultimately cash flows.
Yeah. In a way, they're all interrelated in a way, I think, in our model, as you see as you go along. Sometimes it's very hard to partition and say only one piece affects it in such a way, although that's what we try to do that in the slides here. So if we look now, the next few slides, like that start on slide 9, talk about reporting underwriting results. And as we talked about already, when we measure the liabilities, the expected cash flow discounted and risk adjusted. On day one, we have a residual margin, which is the difference between the premium that we expect to receive or have received and the expected cash outflows. That's the under-earned profit in that contract. The unearned profit in the contract will be released over time according to the pattern of services for the period. So what we're showing in this slide is the direction from the balance sheet to the profit and loss, that you would reduce the residual margin, and that would impact what you would see recognized as your underwriting result.
And your risk margin.
And your it goes on.
You need another arrow.
Well, the another arrow is slide 11. You're ahead of yourself.
Can I ask a terminology question?
Yep.
Underwriting results. Are we defining that as pre-investment income, pre-interest?
No.
Because I think when we've talked about the OCI decision and reason for it, et cetera, we're talking about underwriting result in that context, including the interest and including the interest accretion. So we ought to be consistent with how we're using that term.
Okay, we decided we would rely on IAS 1 for the presentation and the statement of comprehensive income, so that is pretty fair in terms of what it requires. So it doesn't actually require a line underwriting results, and it doesn't. And as a result, we haven't defined the line. I would have thought most people would probably want to separate the insurance contract revenue, the margin that comes up.
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with this. I think this is fine.
Yeah.
But I'm just concerned about consistency in what we say.
In what we say going forward.
Sure.
So in slide 2, this basically tries to capture slide 10. Slide 10, 11, and 12 talks about the changes in the other building blocks. So what happens here when cash flows changes? Where does the cash flow changes get reported? Then the slide 11 talks about the risk adjustment, and slide 12 talks about the discount rate. So here in slide 10, how are the cash flow changes reported? So if you look, unfortunately I don't have a pointer or anything like that. The cash flow changes that relate to past and current services, experience adjustments if you like, get released to the underwriting result. Now, we have made a decision to adjust the margin only when it relates to the provision of future services. That means that changes that are unrelated, cash flow changes that are unrelated to services, where they do occur, would impact the profit and loss straight away. And changes that relate to future services would be adjusted against the margin. This is a picture of a profitable contract.
Excuse me, just one question on that.
Sure.
On this slide, you've got changes related to past and current services all go to underwriting results.
Yeah.
Didn't you just say one bit goes to underwriting and one to residual margin?
The future services.
Past and current, okay. I'm not very quick.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This margin is more than your...
Yes. So this is a profitable contract, meaning it's not an onerous contract. If it was an onerous contract, meaning the residual margin is zero, all the changes in the cash flows would impact the profit and loss.
Mm-hmm.
So this is effectively a quick and dirty snapshot of the adjusting the margin decision, if you like. Now,
no surprises this far.
Now, as Jan pointed out, what happens to the risk adjustment? Doesn't that also affect underwriting results? And that's what we see on slide 11 here, that any changes in the quantity and price of uncertainty are recognized immediately in the statement of comprehensive income.
My point is really that that's part of the profit for the provision of services.
And you would...
integrated part of that should be presented that way.
Well, it is presented that way because both go to the underwriting results, so that reports the profit of the services. So if you want to look at it that way, it does do achieve that.
Okay.
And that's a key. That's a key difficulty with the model. I think that to the extent that risk adjustment is part of the profit margin in the end, that we have a different treatment regarding the changes in the cash flows as compared to the changes to risk when offsetting against a margin. One is offset, not the other one, and the logics might not be obvious for everyone, except for me.
I think it was a very difficult discussion when the board looked at it, because on one hand, you have to be able to split up current, you know, risk adjustment changes relating to past and current service related to future. And some were worried about the operationality of having to do that. And you also have to be able to split between any services and non-services elements.
But we had the discussion in the past of where you have an adjustment to your expected cash flows towards the end of the contract that you would have set against the margin, but if at the same time your risk adjustment decreases, then you take that element to profit immediately. It's interrelated. The cash flows and the risk can become interrelated. They are not independent.
Yeah.
And we have a disconnect here between the two. I just wanted to stress this point because it's key to this model.
So now moving on to slide 12.
It really is an extra layer of prudence. For those who are...
They won't agree for that.
It can be imprudent. It can be imprudent.
I mean, first of all, we say profit cannot be recognized immediately. It has to be sort of... right? Although we have a fair value estimation of the profit, when we start, we say... there, and you can only release it over time. And then there's another subpart of it that we are so uncertain of that remains to be seen as well.
Well, but your
I'm not saying I'm against it, but
risk adjustment, it goes both ways. It can increase or decrease. If you have a reduction in your assessment of risk this year, you take a profit, and reverse it next year, and you think finally it's more risky, you take a loss. So it's not that prudent. It's going both ways.
Yeah, you can accelerate profit through the business margin.
I guess what we're doing is the same residual margin, the unearned profit. It's like the contractual service margin in the revenue model. We want to adjust that for things which are sort of unexpected changes, whereas it's just expiry of risk, clearing risk over time, providing service over time. That should go to profit and loss so that you can earn that as you provide the services of either bearing risk or providing services. To the extent it relates to future coverage, then changes can adjust the margin. For risk adjustment, that would require you to separate the changes from the risk adjustments which arise from the expiry of the coverage period and any other changes in risk adjustment in either the price or quantity of risk.
Sorry.
When we discussed this, I think most people thought that the risk adjustment in itself was a difficult calculation to do with a lot of subjectivity. Subdividing that further is even more difficult and even more subject to, you know, manipulation, subjectivity, earnings management, whatever. However, given that most of the expiry change in the risk adjustment will be to do with the expiry of risk, then it seems reasonable that that's the amount we want to see in profit and loss over time, and so we've taken the whole lot and treated it in the way that we want to see the predominant component.
But isn't insurance to take a risk? That is a service.
Well, that's why we want to see them recognizing what they earn from the overlord in profit and loss.
Change is profit and loss, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And now we move to slide 12. And here we look at reporting time value changes. And here reflects the fact that we'll be reporting the cost view of the time value changes for services provided in the profit and loss. At the profit and loss, we will also be reflecting the investment returns provided to the policyholder. Here we talked very much about those contractual linked contracts and those that are non-contractual linked, but effectively that will show that. What will be shown in OCI are the amounts that self-reverse over time. And this, the total comprehensive income will allow a current view of the time value. If you were adjusting profit for the current view, the time value of money, that would what comprehensive income shows.
Is the description for the OCI amount complete? Because shouldn't it be that plus the difference between the locked-in rate and the current rate? Because you get an entry there even if there's no discount rate change.
So you're talking about the unwind, like if there was 7.7?
Yeah.
Yep. But that's a natural cause of discounting.
I'm just looking at the description of effective discount rate changes on insurance liability. That in itself is not strictly true.
But it would be if you measured the entire liability in a current view, that's what you would show.
It's a net effect.
It's a net effect.
It's a net effect.
So you should be able to see that anyway.
I was just saying that even if the discount rate doesn't change, you could still have a positive or negative number.
I get your point, but it still will allow you, your total comprehensive income figure should still show you what you would report.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So does it help if you put net effect of the discount rates, word net in front?
I think you have to see that amount in OCI as a balancing figure. I think trying to attempt to describe it rapidly becomes a laundry list of things, and it's your change that happens with the unwind at the locked-in rate and the effective changes. So I think really if you want to understand what's going on, you have to look at what's reported in profit and loss and what's reported in total comprehensive income and accept that there is a difference between those two, and that is the amount that is in OCI. That defines the amount in OCI, really.
Yeah, can you clarify for me the second line, reflects the investment returns provided to the policyholder? You don't always have an investment return. You can have a pure service and you have no investment return. So can you say sometimes can also reflect, but it's not always true, is it?
I think that's correct. We should have put perhaps a bracket, if any. I think that's always if any.
Yeah.
When doing this slide, there's always trying to fit so many words in one bubble. And believe me, that was tough enough. I think I spent most of the
time. I think that's for the benefit of those who listen to our discussion.
I agree. It's if any. Very correct. Yeah. Okay. Now to the third section of the slide. We talk about now we've seen how the changes in the liability are reflected in the impact financial statements. And what these slides seek to do is just to give you a high-level overview of what you should see year for year in both the balance sheet and the profit and loss. So in the balance sheet here, you would see if we start with the assets, because that's the way the balance sheet was laid out, the reinsurance assets would be measured under our model, and they would be measured consistently with the underlying insurance liability. It might seem like an obvious thing to state that other assets are measured consistently with other IFRSs, but some of the struggle that has been in this project has always been whether we are accounting for the insurance entity or the insurance contract liability, and the board has always maintained that it's accounting for the insurance contract liability. And so that was just to merely draw out the point that other assets are accounted for in line with other IFRSs. The insurance liability, I won't go into it too much because we've talked already quite a bit about what its measurement will reflect. It will reflect a current market consistent valuation of that liability. Some people call that an economic view. And it's the same that both other liabilities, non-insurance liabilities, would be measured consistently with the other standards as well. So the next couple of slides work through this statement of comprehensive income.
So, John, well, I think because I think I will use it in the future.
Oh, okay.
But it first the bubble into two, like this.
Okay, you would rather separate the first bubble into two?
Because you separate it later on, you see, into two, you see.
Ah.
Good point.
Somebody else can try fitting the bubbles. Not me. That's a lot of work. The statement of comprehensive income. So it's on slide 15. A very high level, I'm going to start with what revenue and expenses, because I think we spent quite a few meetings in this stage of this discussion talking about what is the right revenue and expenses for the insurance contract. And for the insurance contract revenue, what the boards have decided is something that is consistent, a method that's consistent with how revenue is reported in line with other services. It will effectively reflect the value of the services that the insurer is providing in the current period. So value of service here encompasses obviously things like insurance coverage, as well as these other services that I've talked about that could occur in some of the more complex products. And again, just to emphasize, they would exclude deposit-like amounts. The same would occur for the expenses.
Sorry. Linking the two slides, the deposits, which are assets received, cash or whatever, or invested in, and the deposit liability, which is the contra entry, are they part of insurance contract liabilities?
Yes.
Maybe you should here have a parenthesis on slide 14. Saying including deposit component.
Yes, okay.
Because it's not dealt with by other standards, it's dealt with by this standard.
That's a good point, that sometimes people misunderstand as well, that we are excluding deposits here for presentation purposes only, but that they would be measured consistently under our standards. So that is a good point.
And the key difference there is that because of it would not be subject to the deposit floor, I think is what you're getting at.
Yes. Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine. I think one thing you should be careful, you know, on the first two lines related to revenue expense. Here you say consistent with the other industries, both for revenue expense, you know, because we always like to be precise, you know, and it's still based on the measurement model. I don't think it's purely, you know, consistent with other industry, all right?
Well, it would be on an incurred basis, which is what you would do under IAS 18. So it would be a similar way of
same approach as other industries.
Same approach, maybe?
Well, yes and no, because expected losses in the IFRS 9 impairment is not incurred, so we have to be careful to say it's always the same. Here we talk about incurred, which is you have an incurred claim,
yep.
Whereas in financial instruments, we do have expected losses. So,
because we always emphasize the basic model is measurement model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of expense and revenue is indirect result. We want to reflect.
What about if you say it's consistent with the revenue standards?
The performance obligation.
I don't think it's consistent with the revenue standards, if you really want to start from there, because it is the starting point for this is underwriting results and you add back. And in the revenue recognition, it's the other way around. So it might get to the same point, I don't know, but I don't think it's. The methodology is consistent. I think you should leave it as it is. If you really start specifying its revenue and all, there will be a lot of people say, no, the starting point here is underwriting result. The starting point there is
consistent with the principles in the revenue recognition standard, because often there's a lot of other things in revenue recognition which haven't been fully carried over. So I think consistent with the principles.
All right. I think we've exhausted slide 15, so now slide 16. I'm skipping over the rest of the words. Yeah. I think we all get the point. I think this slide, again, is just a reiteration of what we've been discussing before, what underwriting results would reply. You know, if we took it all together in one piece, it would be changes in the measurement of uncertainty. Here's talking about the changes in the risk adjustment. It would be the margin or profit or loss for the services provided in the period, so the margins that's released in line with the services provided. It would be changes in the cash flows for the current and past services. And obviously, this is only for profitable contracts. For onerous, you would also see them all there. For the net spread, if you were to segregate your profit and loss that way, the investment income would be reported under the scope of the other standards. Again, it's something that we're just reiterating for completeness. And the expense, if any, reflects any investment returns provided to the policyholder. And for the services, the cost view of the time value of money. So that shows you what net profit and loss would be. Slide 17 basically gives, again, the same in another pictorial thing, so I won't go too much into it, that you would have two views of performance here. The net profit and loss would be the performance of providing the services using a cost view, reflecting the cost view of the time value of money, and total comprehensive income would allow you to show the current view of that. Now, we often don't talk about disclosures, which is the next slide. And we just had a slide here to highlight that the disclosures here that we are proposing, I think, are useful to users in understanding the amounts, how the amounts are reconciled. You know, a lot of the reconciliations users will find useful because they should be able to see the expected present value, future receipts and payments, how the risk adjustment changes from period to period, and the changes in the residual margin, how it's adjusted and how it's allocated to profit and loss. And I think an important one is that they will see the effects of new contracts written, because users have told us that the premiums written, how much actual cash is collected is important. Those will be provided in the notes. It is a subjective process estimating the insurance contract liability, and therefore, rightly so, the boards have decided the insurer would need to produce disclosures to talk about the judgment that they have needed to undertake and when they need to change some of their methods and inputs used and reasons for doing that. And finally, there is disclosures on risk, which is very much aligned with what we have in IFRS 7 for financial instruments, the nature and extent of risk, how those risks are mitigated by the reinsurance contract, and any of these participating features, and any quantitative information. These are the sensitivity analysis and how the insurance liability may change under different scenarios to show you how risk affects the measurement of that liability. Now, we have probably 5-10 minutes before I hand over to the next section. Is there any questions on the slides at the back end which talk about the specific application to the specific for short duration contracts, contractually linked cash flows, and reinsurance assets?
Only one in the slide number 20.
Yes?
When you said discounting expedience, the word expedience threw me off a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Is it the liability for the incurred loss, you need to discount it based on the discounting theory? I think that's what you're trying to say there.
Well,
because you said measurement during the coverage period, discounting expedience.
I think maybe a shorthand we were trying to say simplifications that you provided, the ones where you said for the liability for remaining coverage, if it's no significant financing component, you don't need to discount. And again, for the incurred claims, you rightly said that actually, you know, whether it's an expedient, simplifications might have been a better word to use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
For that.
That's the only comment I did. Yeah. Excellent presentation.
So any other questions on the rest of the slides before we hand over?
Yeah, I've got to agree with PK. I think this is terrific. I think the slides are very well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll hand it over to Andrea, the other Andrea.
Thank you, Joanna. We would now like to turn to agenda paper 2C. The purpose of this paper is to illustrate that the ISB have comprehensively addressed the comments received on the 2010 disclosure draft. Agenda paper 2C contains an analysis of the ways in which the ISB has addressed the comments from respondents on the 2010 exposure draft. Agenda paper 2C then goes on to evaluate the ISB's decision in the context of the project's axioms and assumptions. With that in mind, we would like to ask if the ISB has any questions or comments on agenda paper 2C.
Matter of process, we have received today a letter from the industry. I think everyone has read it. Are you comfortable that we have considered all those comments that are raised in this letter? And you say we have done whatever we had. Are we also confident regarding this letter?
We've received a number of letters, actually, not just one letter from various interested parties. And I think we are aware of all the issues in those letters. We've been aware of them as we've come through the deliberation process and as the board has made decisions, which, let's not forget, largely respond to the comments we originally got on the exposure draft. And I think the fact that these letters are being written reflects the same sort of thought process that's caused the ISB to decide to re-expose on those targeted areas. For the most part, they're on the targeted areas. There's some areas where some interested parties are not in agreement with the board on some fundamentals which we have debated in the past. So
disagreement is something we know. We disagree on certain matters, but there is nothing new in terms of matter raised that we need to consider at this moment. Everything has been...
A lot of it has been about the operational complexity, which we knew was something we wanted to go out and assess in at greater detail.
And some of it has been perhaps a different view to where the boards have landed on some of their decisions. For example, mandating the use of OCI for insurance liabilities is a common one we hear from the industry. But it was a decision that the board weighed against comparability, and that's why the board, you know, the complexity and comparability to do with the OCI decision, that's the targeted area. I will have to emphasize that we have, as far, tried to keep people up to date with the project, made them aware. We've even given some staff drafts of earlier decisions because this project has been, you know, I hate to say it, for 2 years since the last ED, and we have, as far as possible, tried to reach out to people to discuss these things. And the best way is actually an exposure draft where everyone can see how all the pieces fit in.
Okay, further comments? Amara, sorry.
Thanks. I just would like to make a general remark about papers 2B, C, and D. I thought they were excellent. Well, the first one is excellent as well, but... there's a particular reason I found that these three papers excellent, because as we approach the closing of the project and the formal balloting, those provide us a clear view of the issues that were brought, how we decided, and the reasons why, the main reasons why we reached those points. So I really commend the quality and the benefit of those papers in helping us in the outreach that's going to come, in the field testing process as well. And I would even suggest that for other projects we would have something similar, because this clearly it's a lot of work to be done that, and I do acknowledge that. But those are, it's an excellent way for us to have a clearer view to where we are heading and why. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Anything further? Okay. Why is it?
At what point, Philip raised questions to, whether we already tried our every effort. Now, I feel, on the OCI, the options we decide to use, we spend time on the basis. Because when we start with, basically, the staff prepared paper say the three reasons volatility and mismatch, what else, you know, and the
regression changes.
And others. Yeah, but actually, you know, what Steve tried to answer is you cannot solve the problem mismatch, you know, and after day two, you know, everything will change. And so we do need to try our best. It's because, you know, people from UK, as I also noticed from Australia, they're against our proposal. And so spend time on it. And also we are now, at conceptual level, we also tackle these issues and whether we can find a common ground. And otherwise, you know, views will still be hugely split.
Okay. Any further?
Thank you.
Thank you. 9 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you.